Well, during the height of COVID, when so many businesses and facilities were closed, so many people were stuck at home, I remember several videos being passed around of fitness coaches who came up with creative ways to exercise at home. One of the more memorable ones began with a coach sitting at home, looking frustrated and discouraged. He couldn't make it to his local gym until he had an epiphany. I can turn my home into a gym. What follows is a combination of inspiration and comedy as he turns a 5-gallon water cooler into a giant kettlebell, as he turns his kitchen island into a dip machine, and my personal favorite, turns his 1-year-old toddler son into a 20-pound curl barbell. Kids, don't try this at home. The video ends with the coach saying something along the lines of, "It's all a matter of perspective." Well, in a similar kind of way, Ken Sandy begins his book, The Peacemaker, by exploring the connections between our perspective about conflict and our responses to conflict. On the one hand, many of us are irritated by, dread, or even loathe conflict. Dislike of conflict can be motivated by a variety of factors. Maybe you've got more of a retiring personality. Maybe you've been burned in the past. Maybe it's the belief that nothing good ever comes out of conflict. Maybe it's just a simple desire to keep things light and fun. Whichever of these factors or perspectives might describe you, the common denominator is the same: a tendency to think conflict isn't worth it and to avoid it at all costs, escaping. On the other hand, some of us tend to have the opposite instincts when it comes to conflict. Some of us seem to just thrive on it. Some of us are energized by conflict and find it brings our abilities and focus, and learning into focus. Some of you grew up with a little brother who seemed bored without a good conflict and could always think of a way to start one. And some of you were that little brother. Others of you might not enjoy conflict, but still see it as an important moment to fight for what you care about, what you think is important, what you believe in. While this more aggressive tendency may be motivated by strong convictions, a righteous desire to defend the innocent, a good desire to protect the good, the true, and beautiful, by personal resolution, never to let that bad thing from your past ever happen again on your watch, by selfish anger, or just by pure testosterone, the common denominator is the same: a tendency to think that important things are at stake in conflict and to respond by attacking. Now, in this fallen world, we should acknowledge that both kinds of responses are sometimes necessary. There are some conflicts so pointless, so dangerous, or so impossible that wisdom calls for an escape response. Think of David running from Saul. That wasn't cowardly or lazy, that was honorable. On the other hand, some conflicts are so important and so antagonistic that nothing less than an attack response will do. Well, David was right to run from Saul. He was also right to use the most extreme form of attack with Goliath. He killed him. But while both attack and escape responses are sometimes necessary in this fallen world, they are rarely ideal, especially when it comes to our brothers and sisters in the Lord, our family and friends, and the neighbors whom God has called us to love as we love ourselves. Sandy calls attack responses peace-breaking. It's obvious how those destroy peace and damage relationships. Maybe less obvious, but equally important to think about, Sandy calls escape responses peace-faking, because they usually just kick the can down the road, they leave landmines everywhere, and produce shallow relationships and loneliness. So instead of breaking peace or faking peace, Sandy calls us to make peace. And the place to start, he suggests, is with changing how we view conflict. Rather than viewing conflict primarily as something inconvenient or unseemly or dangerous, or primarily as a battleground to assert my wants, my opinions, my sense of justice and righteousness, Sandy calls us to view conflict as an opportunity to glorify God, to serve others, and become more like Christ. And that is exactly what we see in our sermon text this morning. 1 Corinthians 10, 23 through 11, 1 models this perspective for us. Notice it as we read it together. All things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbor. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, "This has been offered in sacrifice," then don't eat it for the sake of the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I don't mean your conscience, but his. For why should my liberty be determined by someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or Greeks or to the Church of God. Just as I try to please everyone and everything that I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they might be saved. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. This is the word of the Lord. May the Lord give us the grace to understand, believe, and obey his word. Well, here in our sermon text this morning, Paul models the perspective of a peacemaker. He sees conflict as an opportunity to glorify God, serve others, and become more like Christ. Remember that conflict is one of the key themes here in 1 Corinthians. Throughout this letter, Paul addresses a variety of disagreements, differences, and divisions in this church. Divisions over who baptized who, Paul, Cephas, or Apollos. Differences of preference and opinion about which was the best teacher, whose style they liked the best, who was their favorite, who they wanted to follow. Disagreement over whether men and women should wear, you know, head coverings when they prayed or prophesied. Differences of spiritual gifting that led to chaotic worship services. Disagreements so profoundly mishandled that they were taking each other to court. Divisions so entrenched that when they observed the Lord's Supper, one faction got drunk, the other went away hungry. They even had theological disagreements over things as significant as the resurrection and meat sacrificed to idols. Look again at this passage and think about this specific conflict that Paul addresses in these verses. Here he's continuing a theme he started in chapter 8, the disagreement over whether you can eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols. Remember that in the world of antiquity, meat and worship were closely associated. Animals were a precious form of wealth, and most forms of worship in the ancient world, whether true worship, Jewish or pagan, often involved animal sacrifice. As Pastor Stephen taught us in a sermon recently in Deuteronomy, even in the Hebrew Bible, the connection between meat and worship is so close that Hebrew only has one word for slaughter and sacrifice. We have two words, they only had one. Not all forms of sacrifice, of course, involved eating some of the meat. Think of the ascension offering of Leviticus, the whole thing was burned up. But many of them did, for example, the peace offerings. And while these Corinthian Christians would not, or at least should not, have been worshiping by animal sacrifice, because they're Christians and believe in the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus, they nonetheless lived in a city that was dominated by pagan worship. They couldn't escape this issue. The ancient equivalent of grocery stores, their meat markets, were mostly filled with meat from animals that had been sacrificed to Zeus or Apollos. If they went to get the ancient equivalent of a local hamburger, it was probably meat that had been sacrificed to Diana. And when relatives or friends invited them over for dinner, they were probably served meat that came from the local idol shrine. And so the Corinthians disagreed over whether it was sinful to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. So the group that Paul calls the weaker brothers thought, it's sinful anytime you eat that meat, and even if it's been carefully separated from that context, you know, it was slaughtered there, it was brought to the market, you brought it home, still, whoever was involved in pagan worship, you eating it involves you with that pagan worship. But those whom Paul calls the stronger brothers strongly disagreed. I mean, come on, guys, meat is meat. The possibility that pagans might have said some superstitious hocus-pocus over it before they slaughtered it, butchered it, and took it to the market is irrelevant. I mean, you didn't participate in that idolatrous worship. You didn't say the hocus-pocus. You just ate meat and ate it, you got it in good conscience. You know, their rituals don't magically change the meat or contaminate it. After all, God made animals, and God gave animals for us to eat. If Larry Norman had been one of the stronger brothers, he might have sang, "Why should the devil have all the good meat?" Notice that this conflict is not, like so many of the most common conflicts in churches, a matter of practicality, preference, priority, strategy, or administration. It wasn't a matter of where to cut the budget, how many missionaries we should support, how to structure the church's ministries, what to throw away, and where to store the things that we don't throw away, whether or not we can have guitars in our worship service, what the building should be used for during the week, and who gets to use which room at what time for what purpose, how many announcements there should be before the service, whether the nursery should go to age 2 or 3, whether a decision is rightly in the purview of the session or the diaconate, or what color the carpet should be. No, this is something much deeper. This is a theological disagreement. If the weaker brothers are right, then the stronger brothers are committing a serious sin. And if the stronger brothers are right, then the weaker brothers are on their way to becoming Pharisees, in danger of adding man-made rules to God's law and lording it over the consciences of others. Now, granted, it's not a primary issue in theology. It's not a matter of heresy. But the question still had important consequences. And besides, theology is always important. Surely churches have split over far less. If this conflict was happening today, it's not hard at all to imagine these two parties forming rival denominations, the meat abstainers, the meat eaters, the fundamentalists, the libertines, the conservatives, the progressives. If you think that's a stretch, just consider how many denominations exist because of theological conflicts, let alone other kinds of conflicts, over secondary issues. I mean, even just within our own conservative, evangelical, Presbyterian neck of the woods, there are dozens of denominations that are virtually identical, where we agree on inerrancy, the regulative principle, the Westminster Confession of Faith, but still remain separated by one or two theological differences. Exclusive solemnity, eschatology, the liberty of conscience when it comes to alcohol or tobacco, whether we can serve communion to children, women deacons. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that any of these theological conflicts are trivial. I'm here at this church and not at my last one, largely because of just one such theological difference. I'm not denying that there's a time to break away and form a new denomination. Our denomination was formed in such a movement, and I'm certainly not denying that there's a time to fight for our theology. I am, after all, named after John Knox. Instead, what I am saying is that when it comes to disagreeing with brothers and sisters in the Lord on a secondary matter, Paul's instinct was neither to escape nor to attack. His mindset was to approach it as an opportunity. The first opportunity that Paul highlights in this passage is serving others. Look again at verses 23 through 30 and notice Paul's emphasis on seeking the good of others in this conflict. All things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbor. Notice how that statement, all things are lawful, is in quotations and repeated. That's because most likely this was a slogan that the stronger brothers were using in their argument against the weaker brothers. And notice how Paul responds to it each time with a call to serve the weaker brothers. What makes Paul's response so remarkable is Paul agrees with the theology of the stronger brothers. The verses that follow clearly demonstrate that. He says, eat whatever is sold in the meat market. Don't raise any questions about where it came from. He says, likewise in chapter 8, food will not commend us to God. We're no worse off if we don't eat, and no better off if we do. But even though Paul agrees with the stronger brothers on this question, he still exhorts them to look for opportunities to serve the weaker brothers in this conflict. Just think about how Paul could have responded to this conflict. He could have torn the weaker brothers' argument to shreds. He could have written a long, angry theological treatise refuting their error, which is what he did when he wrote the book of Galatians to refute the Judaizing heresy. He could have assumed the worst about the weaker brothers and interpreted their words and actions in the most negative light. You know, y'all are acting like a bunch of self-righteous, legalistic, uptight, power-hungry Pharisees who want to lord it over everyone else's conscience. Knock it off. Or he could have just ignored the conflict entirely. Seriously, we're going to argue about whether or not you can eat meat? This is stupid. I don't have time for this. Come on. Instead, he answers the theological question clearly, briefly, and graciously. And then he points the stronger brothers to this North Star. Conflict is an opportunity to serve others. What is helpful? What will build up? What will do good and bless those whom you disagree with? Are those the kind of questions that you ask in your conflicts? When you're frustrated that your kids left a mess again? When your brother got 2 donuts and you only got 1? When your spouse is making you late again? When someone's comment rubbed you the wrong way and got under your skin? When you think church leadership has blown it? How can I serve others right now? Or like the stronger brother, are you just thinking, I'm right, they're wrong, and they're stepping on my rights, messing up my life, getting in the way of what I think is right and good? Paul's instruction to the stronger brothers is a reminder to us that it's possible to be on the right side of an argument, but to be completely wrong in how you go about it. It's possible to be logically correct, even theologically correct, in a way that is unhelpful to the church, in a way that tears down your brothers and sisters, in a way that does no good to your neighbor. Do you see conflict as an opportunity to serve those whom you disagree with, to do good to those who have offended you, to build up your opponent? Conflict is an opportunity, sometimes the very best opportunity, to serve others. Well, secondly, conflict is an opportunity to glorify God. Look again at verse 31 and notice how Paul concludes this instruction. So, therefore, in the King James, whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Now, if you've been a Calvinist for any length of time, I'm sure you've had this verse just beaten into your head. You know, it's one of the first proof texts of the first question and answer, shorter catechism. man's chief end, to glorify God and enjoy him forever. The idea that we should do everything to the glory of God is right at the heart of the Reformed worldview, and yes and amen to that. But what we easily forget when we use this verse as a proof text is that in its original context, it was not a critique of monasticism, a contradiction of pietism, an argument against an overly rigid sacred-secular divide, a call for Christian education or the building of Christian institutions, a proclamation of the Lordship of Christ in the public square. Now, maybe all those are legitimate applications or implications of this verse. But in its original context, it was a call to remember our highest goal and priority in conflict. What does the glory of God have to do with who gets to use the bathroom first? What does the glory of God have to do with whose turn it is to do the dishes or who forgot to take out the trash? What does the glory of God have to do with the look on your face when you talk to your parents, or the tone of voice that you use when you talk to your children, or the body language that you use when you talk to your siblings? What does the glory of God have to do with whether or not we decorate the sanctuary with poinsettias at Christmas time? What does the glory of God have to do with which classroom you get to use for Bible study? So often in the little moments of conflict and frustration that make up the bulk of our lives, the only honest answer that we could give to those questions and 1,000 others that are so similar would be apparently nothing. But Paul in these verses is teaching us that for the Christian, the answer must be everything. Because the compass that we are called to live by, the animating question of our lives, ought to be, what will please and honor God in this situation? Being a peacemaker does not come naturally to sinners. What comes naturally to sinners is to attack or escape from the neighbors that God has called us to love. So often, God's commands in conflict are completely counterintuitive. Love your enemies? Pray for those who persecute you? Turn the other cheek to your adversary? In humility, count others more significant than yourself? Look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of someone that you think is wrong. Ask forgiveness from the person that you're mad at. Believe the best about those that you have differences with. Never avenge yourself, but leave it to the Lord. Be slow to anger, slow to speak, and quick to listen to those who you think are just flat wrong. Overlook offenses. Gently restore the brother that has offended you. Get the log out of your own eye before you point out what's wrong with your sister. Forgive 70 times 7. You see, when we obey God's counterintuitive commands in conflict, it brings him glory because it shows that we trust him more than we trust our own fleshly instincts. When we follow the directions that run so opposite to our instincts in conflict, we demonstrate that we are under the influence of the Holy Spirit. Obeying these kinds of commands in conflict shows that our highest priority is not getting our own way, having a comfortable, easy life, but pleasing him. It shows that our greatest treasures are heavenly, not the earthly things we're fighting over. Do you see conflict as an opportunity to glorify God? And thirdly, conflict is an opportunity to become more like Christ. Look again with me at the last few verses of this passage and consider Paul's final word on this situation. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. Here in these last few verses, Paul broadens out from this one question of me to the bigger issue of not being a stumbling block to anyone. For Paul, this is really the crux of the issue, and it's the common denominator between the meat question and many others that came up in his ministry. If eating meat in the presence of weaker brothers would cause them to violate their own consciences or would tempt them back into idolatry, then the stronger brothers should be willing to just let go of the meat, at least when they're around the younger brothers, even though Paul agrees there's nothing wrong with eating meat. In a similar kind of way, remember that Paul circumcised Timothy when they were going out on evangelistic missions to the Jews, not because Paul believed that circumcision was necessary for salvation. He was the number one opponent of that doctrine, but rather because he didn't want to be an unnecessary stumbling block to Jews who didn't yet understand the gospel. In each of those cases, Paul calls on Christians to sacrifice some of their rights to protect or promote the spiritual well-being of others. This is what Paul means when he says, be imitators of me. You know, church planting among this hugely diverse group throughout the ancient Roman Empire required Paul to make all kinds of sacrifices of his rights and privileges. You know, the right to be paid, the right to marry, the right to remain an up-and-coming member of the Pharisees, the right to have a stable, peaceful life, to continue the Jewish customs that he was raised with, et cetera, et cetera. But these sacrifices pale in comparison when we think about the second half of this exhortation, as I am of Christ. In Philippians 2, Paul described Christ this way. Though he was in the form of God, he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but humbled himself, emptied himself, taking on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. The gospel is a story of conflict between a holy God and sinful people. That conflict is resolved by the willingness of Jesus to let go of his divine rights and privileges, to live the life we should have lived, to die the death we should have died. Jesus is the ultimate peacemaker. He saw in our conflict with God the opportunity to serve us, to bring glory to his Father, and to display his character as Savior. Therefore, as his disciples, we must see in conflict the opportunity to become like him, to put on more of his virtues, to see more of our own sinfulness and need of his grace revealed, to sacrifice more of our resources and rights for the good of others, and to show the world the power of the gospel. Amen?